Hello, this is Mark Shanton, welcoming you to Theatre Voice's regular monthly critical roundup. Charles Spencer of the Daily Telegraph, Matt Wolfe of the International Herald Tribune, and David Benedict of Variety join me to discuss two new musical productions and three plays. Let's turn to the musicals first, which are Andrew Lloyd Webber's new stage version of the 1939 film The Wizard of Oz at the London Palladium, and by complete contrast, the Donmar Warehouse's UK premiere of the 2005 Broadway musical The 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. The Wizard of Oz stars Danielle Hope as Dorothy, who was chosen by public vote last year in the latest BBC reality TV casting show, Over the Rainbow, and also marks the return to the London stage of Michael Crawford as the Wizard. The show also marks a theatrical reunion for Andrew Lloyd Webber and lyricist Tim Rice, providing four additional songs to supplement the existing film score by Harold Arlen and Yip Harburg. It is directed by Jeremy Sams, who also adapted the show with Lloyd Webber, and designed by Robert Jones, who are the same team behind Lloyd Webber's 2006 production of The Sound of Music, which started off the whole reality TV casting bandwagon when Connie Fisher won the vote to play Maria. First of all, Matt, do you think that the TV casting idea has been vindicated by this as well as the other casting shows, you know, for Joseph and Oliver?
Well, I've never watched any of these, as people in this room probably know. So whenever I see the winners in their chosen vehicle, they're entirely new to me. The funniest was in Spamalot, when they had a Swedish reality television program to cast a West End starring role, which I thought was hilarious. Danielle Hope was the winner. I'd never seen her on TV, never heard of her before. She's kind of efficient. She gets the job done, which is sort of emblematic of the show as a whole.
Indeed, it probably would have been a newcomer anyway. It's the sort of a role that would have to be a young performer. There aren't that many.
Well, Imelda Staunton did it at the RSC. Not a long time ago. Yeah,
a
fairly long time ago. But she was an experienced actor at that point. She wasn't.
But they cast it much older in that case.
I mean, I think that some of the reviews today have rather got it in for Danielle Hope. Probably because people disapproved of the method by which she was cast. I'm not saying that I applaud that method of being cast, but I don't think it's Daniel Hope's problem. I think that everyone's going, well, of course she isn't vulnerable. And you go, you try being vulnerable in the middle of the Palladium stage, in the middle of Robert Jones's amazing sets. She is entirely dwarfed by the production. Of all those reality people that I've seen, whether that was the casting of Grease or Jodie Pranger in Oliver or Lee Mead, I think she's the one that's actually got some talent. She never oversteps the mark. She never plays cute. She never bleats at the audience. She's actually playing truthfully and quietly and getting on with the job, which is what you expect of a much more experienced actor than Danielle Hope.
I actually interviewed Andrew Webber last week, and he said that a performer like her would never have come under his radar in any other way. Charlie, what has your opinion been on the reality TV syndrome?
I'm in two minds about it. I can't bear to watch them because I can't bear the camp host Graham Norton, and I find the whole thing, the sort of extravagance of it and the sort of hysteria of it, actually I find repellent. I did watch the first one. The Sound of Music one a bit, and I watched a bit of the Joseph one, but really life's too short, I think. So I came to Daniel Hope completely new, and I thought, David, you were rather praising her with faint dams. I mean, you know, she was efficient and she got the job done. But you do need a bit more in that role, I'd have thought. I mean, she hasn't got
a close-up. Judy Garland has a close-up.
Yes, of course she has. But, fair. I mean, she was perfect. She came through it with her dignity intact. I just felt the whole... I mean, I hate the film, which I'm probably in a minority, but I find that mixture of cruelty and sentimentality that just so often the reverse sides of the same coin... absolutely vile, and I never saw it as a child, and I'm very glad I didn't, because it would have given me nightmares. It's all right, this show. It's just sort of, I just think, what, why? You know, it's apart from making everyone a lot more money, it just seems to me to be sort of a soullessly efficient, and that's it, really. And brilliantly designed, I will give it that. It really is well designed.
Indeed it is. I mean, it is obviously a commercial proposition in the sense that you get free advertising on the BBC for 8 weeks to cast the show, and then the audience have voted for her and they were going to come out and see her.
And also there's this thing in London called Wicked, remember, and everywhere else in the world, where everyone's seen the prequel, so now watch The Wizard of Oz, which, you know, is the story that you think you know. The problem with this production is that's all it gives you. Unlike something like Nehigh's production, A Brief Encounter, which ran away from the letter of that text, a similarly iconic, I hate that word, but it actually is an iconic film, ran away from the letter of the film and retained all of its spirit. This, apart from some new songs by Lloyd Webber and the addition of bits of Mussorgsky and Prokofiev in the orchestrations. This sticks so closely to the film, and you go, a film is not stage. Form and content are different things. As we keep saying, it's very efficient and it does everything you expect. But there's a moment where they were walking along the yellow brick road, which is a tilted drum revolve, just like they've got at the National. Therefore they're walking on the spot in order to look like they're travelling. And I thought, the trouble with this is they're going nowhere, and nor is the show.
There was one wonderful emblematic moment of that, I thought, where Toto, who steals the show and I hope has a very good agent, I think we saw Dazzle.
Was it Dazzle? I couldn't find out. I was wondering if they were using several of them on the same night, because my word, he acted his socks off there.
Well, there was one bit where Dorothy, in the midst of sort of corralling her friends who join her, the Tin Man et al., Toto was kind of yanking at the lead, looking off stage as if he wanted to be somewhere else. And I thought, yes, I know the feeling.
Yeah.
I think
he didn't like that revolve, did he?
No.
I think
Charlie put your finger on actually the problem with it, which is that it's sort of fundamentally pointless, beyond just being a machine to make money. And of course, there's nothing wrong with making money, but it seems to me, if you want to take a title, which we all know from the iconic movie, and we also know because the stage show is actually done, or a version of the stage show is done in London all the time.
Yes, why not?
I've seen four or five different productions of it.
Including a terrible one that Jude Kelly did at the Royal Festival Hall a few years ago. Which was
nothing will be worse than that.
But it needs to be reinvented. It really needed a sort of someone with a bit of vision to say, you know, we are going to turn this into a proper stage musical for the first time ever. Yeah.
And you know, that was the intention, the much publicised notion. We're giving it an opening number. Well, the opening number is sort of souped up underscoring. I mean, and there are all sorts of things where you go, why is there no dance arranger on the credits? Why hasn't Arlene Phillips, the choreographer, gone in and gone, right, what this show needs is to lift. We need to build temperature in the auditorium. We need to find something really exciting. There are two dance numbers. The first one stops after about 2 minutes. It gets some applause because Hugh Vanston puts a button on the number with the lighting change. And the other one is big and full of contemporary dance cliches. And you go, you've got a whole load of dancers here. Why are the dance numbers so flat? And it's because they're sticking to so much music that was written, and they're sticking to all the plot that was written and the lines that were written, and then they throw in sort of knowing panto jokes. And
well, there's also one very funny visual joke at the expense of Wicked, because of course at the end of the first act of Wicked, Elphaba ascends to the sky, kind of, you know, hoisted above us. And here, when the Good Witch comes in, she descends from the sky in a sort of visual inversion. Mm. And that was kind of clever. But then you're going into kind of Spamalot territory of let's take the piss.
And talking about Spamalot, Hannah Waddingham, who was in Spamalot. Well,
she's the best thing in it.
By a mile.
She's just such fun.
But also, there is one very good Tim Rice lyric, which is where she's witty, she's clueless, I know I want her shoeless, which I thought was very good.
Yes.
But you know that
she's normally pretty, she's kidding, sorry.
Normally, Scarecrow steals this show, and it's no fault of Paul Keating's that he doesn't. I think Ebba Baker-Julie does a nice job of being witty as the Tin Man. It's just that all the human characters are dwarfed by huge, beautiful sets, and the need for the show to keep moving. There's no moment of repose. There's no moment of proper stage connection. As I say, it's partly because people are robbed of close-up, which the film will give you, where you can see people looking at one another with intensity, and you can't do that on the stage. But therefore, the scenes need to be rewritten in order to supply that. You know, we all sat there, and I could feel that the whole of that 2,500 people sitting in the Palladium going, ooh, at sets, and ah, at various things. But you don't really feel anything. You're not taken anywhere.
No, and actually, don't you think every musical one requires one sort of moment that seems to encapsulate the whole show and creates a real feeling of wonder? Well, the sets are good, but they never quite reach that height where you think, wow, no, this is why I'm in a theatre.
At times they're a bit threatening. At the beginning of the second act, it looked as if Hannah Waddingham was taking us to a leather bar in Vauxhall.
Yes.
As they were all leaping about, I thought, have I wandered into a wrong theatre all of a sudden?
They got the fly right, unlike Spider-Man. In fact, actually, I mean, there wasn't quite so much flying, but there was very little that Spider-Man's got that this show hasn't. I mean, they're travelling across the stalls and they're flying right up into the roof, and not a murmur about flying problems.
And no delays.
And no injuries so far, touch wood.
I did think that Michael Crawford wins some kind of inverted prize for shamelessness. I mean, there is nothing to do. He's got a new number that's completely anodyne, and he's got a bizarre number at the end of Act One, Bring the Broomstick, which is done basically in voiceover. So the audience doesn't know where to look. So the number sort of collapses because you just hear him thundering about Bring Me Back the Broomstick. But his first entrance is Without Shame, where he comes on with his head bows on a revolve, and just as he sort of hives into view, he cocks his head up and virtually winks at the audience in order to get an entrance mm-hmm. round.
Yeah,
which
he
you
does.
Go, he's not in the show, he's just there performing.
High school musicals, of course, are all the rage, not least with Disney's High School Musical series and TV shows like Glee, which draws on a knowing irony as it celebrates a group of outsiders who find a sense of community in performing covers of music hits. In the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee at the Donmar Warehouse, another group of high school outsiders find their own sense of purpose by competing in national spelling competitions in a musical that has music and lyrics by William Finn and a book by Rachel Scheinkin and is directed by Jamie Lloyd. Matt, can I start with you? Did you see this in New York?
Yeah, I did.
I did too, and it's totally different, isn't it?
Well, it seems very strange. I mean, you know, I'm all in favor of cross-pollination of shows, as everyone here knows, but this is perhaps one of those shows that doesn't cross-pollinate very well. Even I, as an American living in London, felt rather weird standing in the Donmar, reciting the Pledge of Allegiance to the American flag, and looking at me as if I was some sort of resident freak. And also, maybe it's just sort of ODing on award season, but all of its commentary on the win-lose culture amidst which we live now seem very tired, sort of 6 years after the fact. I enjoyed it a lot less here than I did in New York.
Of course, we're very used to the frame of reference. I mean, I was the high school genre now is so well known thanks to High School Musical. So we do understand that, but it did strike me as slightly odd to. I mean, we're plunged by the design into a high school basketball court, and the whole thing just feels kind of laboured.
I kind of went with it. I had not seen it in New York. I downloaded the score and then decided not to listen to it. I just thought, look, I'm just going to go and watch this as a show, cold. And I would be the last person to suggest that this is a lost masterpiece. But I thought it was fun, and it's got enough edge to stop it being entirely sentimental. There are some knockout performances. David Finn as the fat boy. And you will understand if you haven't seen it why I call him the fat boy once you've seen the show, is tremendous and, you know, absolutely not leading, standard leading man material.
That is the scene-stealing role.
That's
the boy won the Tony Award.
But I thought it was done with tremendous grace and elan, and, you know, he's a big guy and he's weirdly graceful. It's just got enough grit in that performance that some of some of the rest of the show does not have.
It does actually, it seems to me, have even less plot than Million Dollar Quartet, for instance. it's a show that it's just a statement, isn't it? It's just, we're going to go and participate in a spelling bee competition. And indeed, on press night, one of our number, Henry Hitchings, who is quite a cunning linguist.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, was corralled on stage to misspell a word. Charlie, did you relate to the show at all?
No, I really didn't. And I'm just baffled why the Donmar felt the need to do it. I mean, it's just so much not a Donmar Warehouse show. I mean, it could have sort of gone on in the West End. It wouldn't have run in the West End.
It would have been good at the Meunier.
Or the Meunier, yeah. Or something like that. It's a Meunier show. And I mean, and also after seeing, you know, after seeing Passion by the same director, I mean, you just wanted, you know, why? What drew him to this? Did they see a commercial future in it? Unlikely. I mean, I know that the high school genre is popular, but I don't think it's ever going to be a hit here. If it was a sort of naked bid for a transfer, it was colourful, it was loud, it was cute, and it really got on my tits.
I mean, I do think that there are better William Finn shows that we've not seen.
Well, the thing about it is, and it's interesting, David, that you didn't listen to the score having downloaded it, because I hadn't listened to the score since I'd heard it 6 years ago. And I remember liking it quite a bit at Circle in the Square and not liking it very much here, and wishing in a way that I were seeing Falsettos, which to me is the great William Finn show. But in answer to Charlie's question as to why, on press night they sort of answered that, because one of the words that somebody had to spell was lachrymose. And when used in a sentence, the sentence was, staging a musical comedy made a change from the theater usual lachrymose fare, which for me was the single funniest moment of the whole night. Yes.
And I, in defence of Jamie Lloyd, you know, why do Passion and then do this? I mean, you know, I'm assuming that he really liked the show, and that it's a fun thing to do. I do think it's a Marmite piece. Either you decide to go with it, and I have to say, some of our peers and a lot of people sitting around me clearly didn't know what to make of it. I was sitting next to a member of the public, I don't know, maybe related to somebody in the show, I don't know, who was ostentatiously bored for 20 minutes, And then I could absolutely feel him going, you know what, this isn't as bad as I thought. You know what, I'm having a really good time. I didn't expect to. And he was completely loving it. And I think that there is something about the show that is appealing. The production is very bright and it's very sparky and it knows what it's doing. And you know, if you decide not to go with it, nothing on earth in this show is going to shift you, because it doesn't have the depth to pull you into something.
Or the tunes, actually. I mean, I do think that the score is very disappointing. They're very bright and very bouncy and completely forgettable.
And also, a lot of the jokes, maybe this is having seen the show once, but a lot of the sort of running gags, like the fat boy who's called Barfay, they keep getting his name wrong, and actually it gets pretty tiresome pretty early on. And no matter how good the actor is, and it's been played well on both sides of the Atlantic, it wears thin.
And also the poignancy doesn't really come off. No. I mean, the girl whose parents haven't turned up, they ought to be able to make much
with
more
with the mother
of
in the Indian ashram, Olive.
And also, I mean, Catherine Kingsley plays Rona, the sort of over made up quiz mistress, and you just long for somebody with a much sharper pen to have really gone for that character. It's the show is a bit too safe.
Yeah. I think that role ought to be played by a man in drag. It needs Dame Edna in that role.
And also, I don't know why they inserted a joke about the British voting system in Nick Clegg.
Oh, yes.
That was ludicrous.
It was a terrible joke. And
ludicrous. And landed with a conspicuous thud.
Yes.
And now on to the plays. We have a stage adaptation of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein at the National, a revival of Lillian Hellman's 1930s drama The Children's Hour in the West End, and Richard Bean's new play The Heretic at the Royal Court. Let's begin this section with Frankenstein, which marks the return to the theatre of Oscar-winning film director Danny Boyle, best known for Slumdog Millionaire, for the first time in 15 years. It stars Benedict Cumberbatch and Johnny Lee Miller, who alternate in the title role and that of the creature he creates from performance to performance. We critics were invited to see them both perform each role, but can I begin, Charlie, by asking whether audiences should try to do the same? Do you think they should see both, or is there a particular combination that stands out?
I would definitely say see it once, because it is absolutely spectacular, but when you've seen how it works, it seems slightly less so the second time, and there are some iffy bits in it. But you must see it once if you possibly can, because it's just the most thrilling piece of staging. And conveniently, it seems to me, there is a preferred cast, which would be Johnny Lee Miller as the creature, who is actually very poor as the scientist, but absolutely electrifying as the creature, I felt, and has a sort of intensity about him which Cumberbatch doesn't have. And Cumberbatch himself is terrific as this sort of slightly sexless, well, more than slightly sexless, sort of really creepy and less human person than the creature he's created. But it's a blast, this show, I think. It's just a real thrill. There's bits of staging devices, lighting effects I've never seen in the theatre before. The sort of lights above the audience's head that sort of crackle and generate heat onto your head. I found the whole thing really exciting, and I took my 17-year-old son along, who's not particularly a theatre buff, and he was absolutely knocked out by it. Second time, when you've seen how it works, it doesn't feel obviously so good, and you begin to notice that Nick Dear's script is clunking quite a lot of the time, and there's a sort of time problem with it. You don't really feel the passage of time terribly well, I think, and it's actually a very long drawn out story. I'm not saying that it should be longer, but you need to feel that characters are aging a bit more than they do, but no, it's a blast.
It's quite unusual for us to see something two nights running, and it did feel genuinely immersive the first time.
Yeah, usually when it happens, it's either a Sam Shepard play or it's Shakespeare, so it's very interesting in a new play for this to happen. I thought Johnny Lee Miller was dazzling as the creature, and actually very, very moving, and there's something sort of primal and earthy and gritty about him. And Benedict Cumberbatch seems absolutely in his element as the Doctor, and sort of suggests himself as maybe a Henry Higgins in waiting at some point. This is interesting because there's a sort of sequence of Olivier productions, and I would put Warhorse in this production as well, where it's all about the stuff that can be thrown at the event, which makes an event. But the script really does play a distinct second fiddle. And I'm not necessarily saying this is a complaint, I'm just saying it is a fact. If you want great drama and great writing in your drama, this is not the play for you. If you want a sort of complete immersive experience, I think you'll have a good time.
It is funny, isn't it, when you mentioned that the failures of the scripts in both cases, the two Nicks, Stafford and Deer here, are not the, you know, the first playwrights you would necessarily go to for a great play.
Well, the interesting thing about Nick Deer is that he has done one absolutely brilliant adaptation. His film of Persuasion that Roger Michell directed is the best Jane Austen adaptation bar none. It's absolutely wonderful. If you haven't seen
Except
it, get
Clueless.
It on DVD. Apart from Clueless, which is in a slightly different category. But he did also do the Villains Opera, which is one of the National Theatre's legendary turkeys, which was pulled early from the Olivier. This is clearly not going to be pulled early because it's such an event, but it's a much better event than it is a piece of sustained drama. And I found myself looking at the floor because some of the acting in basically every role except three, the two we've been talking about, and I think Carl Johnson does a good job of the blind man. Everybody else is doing sub bad rep acting. That's partly because the script is so poor. Ella Smith comes on and does, "Oh, hello, I'm a whore in Les Mis."
she's nice, though. She does have rules.
I'm sure she's a very nice woman. Can be a very nice actor. But she's been very, very bad in this. The man that plays Frankenstein's father-in-law father is giving the single worst performance I've ever seen on the National Theatre stage.
George Harris.
And Naomi Harris, who plays the daughter, is given this role that makes her look like a suffragette. This is 1812. I mean, it's nonsense. And some of the writing is so expositional and so thin. Whenever the main two are on stage and there is a debate going on about why give somebody life, what does this mean, that all crackles and the performances are terrific. Toby Sedgwick needs a shout out for the movement work that he's done with those two actors, but I just found it baffling because at one level the stagecraft is so fantastic, it's been staged brilliantly and directed badly.
Written in 1934 and finally first seen in London in a National Theatre production in 1994, Lynnie Hellman's play The Children's Hour now finally makes it to the West End thanks to the casting of two screen stars, Keira Knightley and Elizabeth Moss, as a pair of schoolteachers who become caught in the crossfire of an inexorable chain of events when one of the schoolgirls lies about them having an affair. David, I assume you saw the previous National Theatre version with Harry Walter and Claire Higgins. Do we really need to see this play again?
I always want this play to be better than it is. You go, it's such an interesting topic. As you know, a theatre archaeologist, you can look at it and go, oh, good heavens, look how this prefigures the Crucible. 20 years beforehand, we've got hysterical adolescent girl, we've got lying, we've got community. But actually, the problem with the play is it's got an incredibly creaky structure. And it, you know, it's got a potentially moving last act. I was really up for it because I thought Ian Rickson did the best Seagull I have ever seen. He is a brilliant director for mapping actors onto naturalistic text. He just gets extraordinary depth out of people. And I thought if anybody can get a performance out of Keira Knightley, it will be him. And I am in love with Elizabeth Moss from originally The West Wing and then Mad Men. So I was really up for it and I was terribly disappointed. I think that everybody is going through the motions except for Nancy Crane as the maid and Ellen Burstyn, who walks away with the show. She's playing the villainess. My heart went out to her and I thought, something's wrong. I'm falling for the one character who really I should feel a bit of pity for, but that's it.
A lot of plays have been made about the young accuser, the young actress, Bryony Hannah. Were you smitten by her, Charlie, as some of our colleagues seem to have been?
Not that much. And in fact, actually, I think that the performance actually makes the play seem even less believable than it is. Because she is so malign, and obviously malign, and everyone knows she's malign. There is no reason why anyone should believe her in the, you know, at all. So that, in fact, actually, the performance that loads of people have praised seems to me she ought to be being played as a rather sweet, innocent girl who everyone believes and who is malign inside. I thought it was a nonsense performance. I mean, it was a very striking performance, but it actually made no sense of the play, and it's probably why a lot of us have complained that it is a creaky melodrama. That it is actually a creaky melodrama, and it doesn't really work. I think Dave was a bit harsh on the leads. I thought they acquitted acquitted themselves with credit, not distinction, but I thought that they were both perfectly adequate and actually as good as the more famous names in the National Theatre production. And I felt the evening as a whole worked better than it did here at the National, where we're broadcasting from now, folks. Someone was also saying that the one review, and I can't remember who wrote it, said that Rickson had more or less sort of rewritten it, and that the first scene didn't have any of Antony and Cleopatra in it. It certainly does in my edition.
I did an interview with Carol Kane, who told me that that was a revision to the text that Lillian Hellman made.
Oh, right.
So that's a later version of the script.
I've got a very old acting edition from New York, at least 15 years old, and it was certainly in there then. I think that's rather wonderful that you got
Antony. I love
that. I thought the first scene was Rickson at his very best, with this, you know, this drunk old teacher and a crowd of adolescent girls reading Antony and Cleopatra. I found that really, I thought that was a wonderful piece of staging, and actually it was downhill all the way after that, really.
It's funny you mentioned Carol Kane. I mean, that was the performance that annoyed the hell out of me. I didn't know what she was doing, really.
It's a little over the top in comparison with some of her colleagues. I have to say, and I'm very happy to go out on a limb here, I thought this production was completely dazzling from beginning to end, and I think it's a great play. And I sort of feel that the press gang up on this play. They are to this play as Mary is to the two women in the play. I mean, sure, you can see the mechanism going, but you can see the mechanisms going in lots of Arthur Miller plays that, God knows, the British prays to the skies. First of all, this is a play about the tyranny of the righteous. We are living this in the United States right now. There are Marys across America in every school district, in every political landscape, ready to do people down. And I thought Ian Rickson excavated the real kind of underlying horror of this play, which is a kind of gathering disgust, so that by the end, when the two women exist in this weird sort of Beckettian stasis, where they've lost any connection to the school is closed, any family ties have gone, Keira Knightley's relationship with her fiancé is over, and they exist in this sort of weird limbo, and then somebody comes in from the outside world, and Elizabeth Moss says, "I've got eight fingers, I'm a freak," and it sent a chill down my spine, as if the collective ostracism had taken root within her. I thought her performance was amazing. For one thing, I'd seen her on Broadway in Speed the Plow, where she was the best Karen I've ever seen by far, and I didn't, but that's such a nothing role, and Mamet doesn't like the character. This is a much more interesting role, and I think that she just gives so much power to it. She also has a wonderful stage voice. Keira Knightley isn't as interesting an actress, but she gets beyond the pouty lower lip. I agree with David about Ellen Burstyn. I'm not sure if I would call her the villain of the piece. Well, I mean, if you listen to the text, what's interesting about it is we're told that her son has committed suicide, and she's never accepted it. So her character is living a lie, and then her character is told a lie. So what happens when you're living a lie and you're in denial about that, and then you're told a lie by somebody who's very damaged, speaking to someone who in her own way is damaged? How does that bear fruit? So I think there's much, much more going on in this play, and I thought Ian Rickson did a great job with it.
I'm going to see it again right after hearing that.
I mean, I would love to see it again. I'll go see it again with you.
It's an interesting one. I mean, I do think one of the things that, you know, is not often talked about with this sort of celebrity casting is that the whole event becomes so dominated about, you know, can the two big names cut it, that perhaps you're less watching the whole play than you would be normally, you know, particularly if you're writing overnight. You know, what you've got to really deliver is a verdict on Knightley and Moss.
Yeah.
And so perhaps, you know, I'd be very happy to give it another go. It just struck me, just as a piece of plotting, and also seeing it here before, at the National before, I can see it's got really great themes in it, and it's satisfying in that way, but it just seems to me that it's the actual exposition and working out of it is not as good
but
as
I thought
it
what
should be.
I thought Ian Rickson did so beautifully by comparison with Howard Davis, who did a pretty good job, and Claire Higgins was wonderful, Harriet Walter less so, because for one thing she couldn't begin to do the American accent, but what Ian Rickson did so well was largely setting the agenda with Antony and Cleopatra, and these giggly febrile girls, and the whole thing about the asp, and it was as if Mary was then unleashed into the world of the play like the asp made flesh. And that I thought was very striking. And to defend Bryony Hannah, I mean, I do a lot of teaching. I'm afraid to say I see girls like this. She is damage on two legs, and yet she's kind of a rag doll. You're not quite sure, can she even stand up straight? But she knows the value of toxicity. And I'm afraid that that is a type of person that's out there.
But I just feel that whilst your analysis
of the play was A, impressive, and B, extremely cogent. It's actually not borne out by the production for me. So Bryony Hannah at the beginning, where she's touching herself, and you go, yes, okay, Ian, I think we probably could have worked out from the play that it is about an adolescent coming to terms with her own sexuality without you headlining it right at the beginning. We're left with little to discover because so much of this is over-signalled. And I loved Mark Thompson's set and Neil Austin's lighting. It has this very strange sort of attenuated mood of strangeness and coldness all night, which absolutely works in the play's favour. But I just thought the performers, for all the detail, were losing it.
What's interesting too, me. I think, about the shape of the play, which is brilliant on Lillian Hellman's oft maligned part, is that, yes, it's about the power of a lie, but what happens in the play is, oxymoronically, the lie gives way to the truth. In other words, if the lie hadn't been perpetuated and events hadn't got to where they get to, Elizabeth Moss's character would never have come out. What would have happened otherwise would have been that Tobias Menzies and Keira Knightley would have got married, and Elizabeth Moss would have been this ghastly, sad third cog in a machine, but she would have lived. Spoiler ahead. As it is, everything is brought to the surface and she pays for it with her life. And it's interesting because the ending of this is not dissimilar to the ending of The Seagull, that you've got a lovesick character who goes off stage and pays for it with his life or her life. Yeah. So I loved it.
One of the other ramifications, though, I think, of the star casting issue is the fact that, and it's a worry I have greatly here, is that Sonia Friedman, the producer, has saw fit to move the top ticket price for the normal top ticket price for this from a £50 top that we've got at the moment in the West End to £60. And indeed, he's going to do the same thing with Much Ado About Nothing when that comes in with David Tennant and Catherine Tate. And beyond that as well, there's also this great new concept of premium seating. So as well as the £60 top, there's also a whole raft of £85 tickets. And I do think this
She brought that in.
Yeah, and I also think this is something we really have to sort of take arms against.
I'm very sorry to hear about the premium seating, which seems to me to be absolutely iniquitous.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, commercial producers, you know, are in it to make money, first and foremost, and they should have to return money to their investors. But I think if we overprice the West End, we run into great danger of just putting a great raft of people off. Finally, the National Theatre recently had a rare flop with Greenland, a play about the effects of climate change, but now the Royal Court have paradoxically scored a bigger success with Richard Bean's The Heretic, which revolves around a university scientist, played by Juliet Stevenson, who finds herself a pariah when she voices her scepticism about the phenomenon. Matt, were you sceptical about this play or in favour of it?
Well, you mean in advance? Or having seen it?
Having seen it.
I enjoyed it. You know, what's hilarious about The Heretic is you kind of think, okay, the combination of Royal Court, climate change, Richard Bean, it's either going to be unbelievably controversial and shocking, or it's going to be very polemical and in your face, or whatever. And instead, it's kind of fun, and it's a feel-good comedy, and it has a Shakespearean ending with a double marriage, and it's actually very sweet. It's incredibly lumpenly structured. There's a whole sort of murder plot, subplot, which goes nowhere, and the denouement of it is right out of the mousetrap. But it's actually a feel-good play about climate change.
I mean, interestingly, I understand this was in fact written as a vehicle for Kristen Scott Thomas for the West End, and ended up at the Royal Court, which sort of explains that. I was very disappointed by this. I've been an admirer of Richard Bean's, but I thought that it seriously didn't know what it was doing. The first act sets up all sorts of jeopardy about this climate skeptic played by Juliet Stevenson, who's working in a university, and against the advice of and against the wishes of her head of department, she publishes some controversial research which will affect their funding. We're supposed to believe that she's surprised that she then gets the sack because she's contravened the rules of the university. And having set up all that jeopardy, towards the end of the play, she gets her job back, and, you know, without any strain, it moves from being this climate change discussion into being a rom-com, a country house murder mystery. There's a song for no apparent reason. It's a mess, and which would be fine, except that you've been led down one line. You've been asked to concentrate and asked to invest in these characters in a certain way that then gets hurled out of the window. It's a bit like Bobby famously coming out of the shower in Dallas, where you were told, oh, well, all that investment that you had in that entire series, don't bother, it was only a dream.
There was a feature in The Guardian as well that suggested that some of it was bad science as well, that actually, you know, what she's propagating is actually not truthful anyway. And it's a bit of a surprise that, you know, he's playing with the wrong dice, as it were.
Well, all I'd say to that is you would get that in The Guardian, wouldn't you? I mean, there is actually basically the climate change, the skeptic's view of climate change is just not getting an airing in the theatre at all. And this play started for me with 3 stars, or even if it had been written in Swahili, had 3 stars on it, just because of the way he was going to approach the subject. What I think, and where I think David is wrong, is I think that it's actually part of this play's aim is to cheer us up. I find the whole thing of this endless worry, this background anxiety of have we ruined the world, are our kids not going to have a future, is so depressing and absolutely unproven, and the orthodoxy has become so established, and every generation, almost every generation anyway, has always thought that the world was going to come to an end from Shakespeare's time onwards. When I was a kid, I can remember worrying endlessly about nuclear annihilation, endlessly, and what a waste of worry that was. And I think the reason that the play goes sort of rather sort of delightfully, I would say, off the rails in the second half is it becomes a sort of celebratory play in an almost sort of Shakespearean way, as you were saying, it's a double wedding.
You've got that enormous wadge of information 2/3 of the way through the second act, where he goes, oh, I better get back to the climate plot. The actors are unable to remember the lines quite clearly because it has no dramatic impact. It's merely a debate where they extract a bit of information out of a computer to prove or disprove somebody else's research.
Oh, I rather like that.
Yeah.
I like that too, actually.
I love the messiness of this play.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's a generous play. Yeah. It's warm. It's got heart. And it's also kind of lovely to see Juliet Stevenson being happy for once rather than all tears and snot.
But also, I think what works about it, I mean, I agree with you, it is sort of an unholy alliance, but what's interesting about it is the way climate change, after a while, seems to become metaphoric, in that the actual climate change that takes place within the play is the relationship between a mother and a daughter. That's what really changes. Mm. And the warming that takes place within the play is between an anorexic daughter and her sort of rabid mother, who by the end of the play have found a way forward, and the anorexic daughter by the end, spoiler again, is pregnant, so she's celebrating increase rather than decrease.
I mean, it's really weird that both climate change plays that appear, you know, you wait, all those jokes, you wait ages for climate change, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, both of them have got polar bears in. Both of them end up, you know, having discussed the future of the planet, both of them end up with, oh, well, all right, just have a baby. It's bizarre. They both end completely sentimentally. I mean, I take Charlie's point about, you know, wouldn't it be great to see a play about skepticism around this subject? And, you know, Juliet Stevenson's character talking about how, you know, I don't believe in anything. I'm a scientist, and therefore you need rigorous proof. That's a completely important and an utterly cogent way of approaching the subject. My problem is that having set up all those expectations, the play then sort of drops them because it doesn't really know how to follow it through.
It's not about climate change.
Because the court has completely missold it. This is being sold to climate change.
Right.
It's not.
What the mother does is she works in climate change. That's her job. But what the play is about, I think, is a family. And I have to give a shout out, partly on behalf of my 15 American students, all of whom are female, who fell instantly in love. I have to give a shout out to Johnny Flynn playing the self-harming Ben, who's so indescribably sweet
and
in
funny.
His role.
It's
and
a
funny.
Very, very good performance.
It's a wonderful performance. And the reason he sings this song is because he's a folk musician who has CDs that all my students have downloaded. And he's immensely winning, but they were disappointed to hear that he has a girlfriend who's pregnant.
Did the students enjoy the play, Matt?
They loved it.
Yeah, I think that's what they're stressing.
And they really identified with it.
Yeah, you can criticise the play technically, and I can see that the second half is slightly messy. The fact is, it is a great feel-good play, and you come out feeling much better than when you went in. And actually, the implausibilities of the ending are part of that.
I think
we should also credit Jeremy Herron, yet another really, really smart production. I think even he can't quite solve problems around Juliet Stevenson, who, when she's doing all those witty lines, they sound to me much more like Richard Bean cracking jokes than Juliet Stevenson cracking jokes. And there's some weird physical stuff around her. There's a fight in the second act, which is really, really messy in the wrong way. And from someone who's directed 11-year-olds in polystenon plays, you know that he can
literally physically stage anything. And if this is really complicated, it's because there's this odd force field around Juliet Stevenson where she clearly doesn't want to be touched or something. It's just very odd, and her rhythm doesn't help the play, but I think his production is very fine.
On that note, thank you, David, Matt and Charlie.